So this morning, David said to me, so you'll come in and you'll just bat cleanup. And Ray said to me, well, what you'll do is you'll do what you always do. After you hear people talk, then you'll figure out how to clarify it and sort of synthesize it. So I can't disappoint the two of them, so that's what I'm going to do. Let me put the following in perspective, based on everything we just heard. First proposition, Gaza is an accident waiting to happen. What do I mean by that? I mean that sooner or later, it's not going to be the issue of the stray missile, it's going to be sooner or later you're going to hit a school in Ashkelon or the power plant in Ashkelon, and it doesn't matter what the Israeli hesitancy about launching a major military operation into Gaza is going to be, that hesitancy will disappear because the context will have changed. Once the context changes politically, there won't be much choice. So Gaza is an accident waiting to happen, first proposition. What you heard basically was, all right, a couple of different approaches. One approach was de-escalation, slash truce, slash ceasefire, tacit, de facto, whatever. And the other one was a major military operation. Now, David says a major military operation wouldn't be a full invasion of Gaza. It would be Rafah, maybe Beit Hanun in the north. Let's put it in perspective. If the Israelis go in, it won't just be about Rafah. It won't just be about tunnels. It will be about stopping rocket fire, which means they have to occupy enough of Gaza to ensure that you've driven beyond the range of these rockets the capacity to launch them. It doesn't mean that's going to be the end of the story, because one of the reasons the Israelis haven't done this, and bear in mind, throughout the whole Intifada, there was pressure within the Israeli military, within the political establishment, within the leadership, during Sharon's time, do you go into Gaza or do you not go into Gaza? Every single time they debated this, they came out and said, there's no good military option, and they didn't do it. So it's not an accident that they haven't done it. But the problem is the context can change in a way that leads them to do it, or at least leads them to do it. And let me put it this way, David. While it won't be designed to be a full-fledged occupation where you're reestablishing Gaza, which you once had, it will be designed to be significant enough that the objective can be stated that we have weakened the Hamas infrastructure for carrying out continuing attacks, even if we can't fully stop it. We've set Hamas back so they're not now going to be the new Hezbollah, which is what they're trying to become within Gaza. Now, do the Israelis want to do that? The answer is no. Is there an alternative to it? Well, you've heard what the alternative is. The alternative is the, quote, de-escalation option. What are the choices? Let me just add one other point before I get into the de-escalation and how you might do it. There is no way, by the way, for the Israelis to go in the way I just described without the cost being very high. Because the only way the Israelis can reduce the cost of their own soldiers is by using an enormous amount of firepower, which means, inevitably, the cost of the Palestinians will be very high. So if the accident waiting to happen takes place, it basically destroys the atmosphere for being able to negotiate. Because Abu Mazen, for all the reasons you said, Raith, Abu Mazen will feel a need to draw back. And David's notion of, well, this could be a submarine. We've got negotiations going on right now. You won't know until they produce something. It's a nice analogy. Doesn't fit, but it's a nice analogy. Why? And you did touch on it. The reason it doesn't fit is because the capacity to make the decisions is influenced by the context. The capacity for each of the leaders to be empowered to take on history and mythology, which is what they're being asked to do, is affected by the context. As long as the context is terrible, neither one of them, no matter what the issues are that are being discussed, I can tell you about the negotiations, because I know something about negotiations, they may be discussing everything, even if they're not admitting it, but they're not making any decisions on anything. So, you know, they can produce a piece of paper of 1 to 5 pages that will have brackets on every single line. Just by the way they did, before they came to Annapolis, there were negotiations, because the purpose of originally the idea of Annapolis was to be where you unveil the political horizon. You know, it was only at the end of the day when Secretary realized she was about to drive off the cliff that she went from trying to produce a political horizon to launching a political process which required nothing of controversy to be said at Annapolis. And guess what? Nothing of controversy was said in Annapolis. So they may be in a submarine, but all they're doing is identifying the brackets. And the context will influence fundamentally whether or not they make decisions. So if the Israelis are driven to go into Gaza because of the accident waiting to happen, pretty much you won't even be able to produce any kind of serious political process or any kind of political outcome. So if that's the case, maybe that drives you back towards the de-escalation option and or the ceasefire option. So let me now sort of explain, drawing on all of what was said, including Jim's points. What does it take to produce something like that? Notwithstanding your seven challenges, one of the ways you can get at it is the following. What can each side gain from a ceasefire option or a truce option or a de-escalation option? And what are the, basically, what are the elements of it? Well, what do the Israelis want? They want an end to rocket fire, and they want to ensure that Hamas can't build itself up because of a truce. What does the PA want? The PA wants to ensure that they reestablish at least some kind of foothold as it relates to Gaza. Not enormous, but some kind of foothold as it relates to Gaza. What do the Egyptians want? Well, David's quite right. Egypt is fortifying the border, but the one effect of what happened is that Egypt now understands that it isn't only Israel that has a stake in what happens in Gaza. The Egyptian approach before, in my assessment, was basically a live and let live. We'll let Hamas operate within certain boundaries as long as they don't cause problems here. So we let them live as long as they don't cause problems here. Well, guess what? Hamas crossed the threshold and created a problem. Now, it's true Egypt is sealing the border, but if it turns out that one thing that the Israelis could do is not only come in, but also at some point look for a way to make clear that, you know what, at the end of the day, we want the rest of the world to deal with Gaza, and Egypt then knows it's their problem, that gives Egypt an incentive not just to control the border, but to do something about smuggling. So three of the parties have an interest in it. Now, the real question is, are there any circumstances under which Hamas has an interest in it? And I would suggest the following. Number one, for all the bravado of the Hamas leaders, in my experience, they hate living underground. Go back and look. Every single time there was a serious Israeli effort to go after them, and they lived underground, sooner or later you saw them coming out with ideas of a truce, almost invariably. So number one, they don't, for all their talk, they don't like living underground. So if in fact they're not going to be the target of attacks, they get to be above ground. Secondly, if you open the crossing points with the PA there, then you really are in a position where even though the PA is able to say we're managing it, it's impossible to achieve it unless the PA is talking, not just Egypt. Right? The one thing at the end of the day, I know that Salam Fayyad's position has been, if we open the crossing points and we're there, we don't have to talk to Hamas. It sounds like a nice theory. It's divorced from reality, but it sounds like a nice theory. The reason it's divorced from reality is because Hamas has a militia that's right there. You put PA, the Presidential Guard, or the National Security Forces in there with guns, guess what? If they're there with guns, and the Hamas militia is there with guns, they're going to talk to each other, or they're going to fight each other at some point. So you would work out an arrangement where, in the end of the day, Hamas will be able to say there's at least normal commerce. Now, will they be able to build up the way they want? Not if Egypt is actually doing much more in terms of stopping smuggling. Maybe it's not a perfect situation for them. Maybe it's not a long-term solution. I would also suggest, by definition, it can't be a long-term solution. But what it does allow you to do is at least create a calm that creates a context where you can at least continue to pursue the political process. And it's an alternative to having to have the Israelis, and it's an alternative to having the accident take place that then produces the Israelis going in a big way, which ultimately doesn't satisfy anybody. Because at the end of the day, if the Israelis go in, they can go in, they can do a lot to set Hamas back, they will do it at a very high price. When they do it at a very high price, that won't be so great from Israel, from Israel's position, and even, I suspect, this administration will cut Israel much less slack than it has in the past. So Israel will have to think about the consequence of doing that. And at the end of the day, by the way, because a Qassam rocket is a pipe, the Katyushas are different. They have to be smuggled in. But the Qassam rocket is a pipe. And you stuff some explosive in it, and you have propellant in it, and you fire it off. And by the way, given the nature of that, you know, it's not something that has a long shelf life. So basically, pretty hard to make sure all those disappear. That means the day after Israel would withdraw, even if they have some extensive period of occupation, the day after they withdraw, there'll be rockets in this derote. Because at the end of the day, there really won't be a military solution to this unless Israel stays in Gaza. The only way you can stop this is by pushing them far enough away that you can't reach Israel. So from an Israeli standpoint, there is something to be gained. I think from the PA standpoint, there's something to be gained. From Egypt's standpoint, there's something to be gained. And from Hamas's standpoint, at least for some period of time, there could be something to be gained. I agree with David that for Egypt, the accountability, and there has to be accountability, and also there has to be, this can't all just be done in a tacit way. I mean, every time you do something tacitly, it's a guarantee that it'll break down quickly because everybody has a different understanding of what it is. So somebody would actually have to spell this out in some detail. And if Egypt is the one mediating, Egypt also has to be accountable for its own obligations. I don't think Egypt will be accountable to the Israelis, but they could be accountable to us. Is it a great solution? No, it's not a solution. All it does is give you the ability to also preserve a certain kind of atmosphere, recognizing that if you want something to be achieved between the Israelis and Palestinians this year, if you don't do something about Gaza now, then sooner or later you're going to have the accident that's waiting to happen, and that will guarantee nothing can be done about the Israelis and Palestinians this year. And that, in my mind, the worst thing about that is it will validate the Hamas narrative once again, which is diplomacy never produces anything, violence always produces something. And if there's one thing this administration shouldn't want as its legacy, that it left Hamas stronger than when it came into office.